All right, I am recording. So I'm going to do a quick sound check. If you just want to say like a testing 1, 2 kind of thing.
Testing 1, 2. Hello, hello, hello. Got the phone off my phone, so you don't hear that either. Smokey, you can't be in the interview.
All right, one more time, testing.
Testing, testing.
Okay, that's better.
Does that heat sound bad in the back?
No.
Okay, I'll make sure. That was what I was worried about.
Yeah, that's all right. All right, this is, you know, just a conversation, but I do have some questions in mind, and you already kind of touched on it earlier, but you're giving me the tour. So first, just asking your name and where you from.
I'm Tiffany Belfield Elamin, and I was born in Austin, Texas, raised in Madison County, Kentucky, grew up in Lexington, Kentucky, and I'm back home in Madison County.
And so, what do you do here?
I wish it was just here. at my residence, I have a farm. We are pollinator conservation. From that conservation, I grow fruits and berries and herbs that complement the pollinators, but I also use it for medicinal and holistic purposes. And I also bring groups out and have retreats and meetings and workshops and around holistic health, the history of the land, and just farm tours, farm-to-table dinners, farm-to-table teas out here actually on the land. We also use it as an event space, so we have people who come out here and do weddings, showers, parties, album releases, field parties, and I live here as well, but I also use my house as a part of a birthing and labor. We've had home births in my house, and we have moms come out here and labor, and we have moms who retreat postpartum just to have a time to heal without the stresses of home. That's what I do here.
And so what do you do elsewhere?
All those things are my interests. Those are my passions. My real job is passion too. I work for Community Farm Alliance. When I was initially brought on, I was the Northeast Kentucky Farm to Table Coordinator. I was in charge of about 14 counties, Madison County all the way up to Greenup. That job was really just bringing growers and producers into the same table to have a conversation about accessing markets. If you're a new farmer and you have a whole bunch of kale, I want to help you find a market for that kale. Farm to school, what does that mean, farm to school? And if in the reverse, you know, I'm a farmer and I know all these people that need this stuff, but I don't know how to procure it. I don't have a place to store it. I need help connecting them to the resources in Kentucky agriculture to make sure that they're fully supported as they are starting or if they have limited resources, etc. But what I found out, similar to me going through me having the farm, my grandparents died 3 and 5 years before I got the job at Community Farm Alliance. So I really knew little about owning my own land. I just worked it. So when I got the farm, I was like, I'm going to have a business. I'm going to have a farm. I'm going to keep going. And I had no idea how to navigate that. And as a Black person, it was even harder to navigate that. So while I was working at Community Farm Alliance and I'm trying to help these farmers and me have my land and be a beginning farmer too, I realized, like, dude, there is no person at the table that looks like me. And as I was doing work with Community Farm Alliance, just put me at tables with Kentucky Department of Ag, putting me at the tables with USDA, having to work with them and coordinate programming and grant funding for Kentucky agriculture and local food systems, I realized that even then, the community, you aren't hearing the voices of the Black and brown people. You're not hearing the voices of the people in the urban areas. This sounds really like a very biased, very blanketed thing that y'all just have money, we're just going to do it. But there's a whole community that you're not reaching. There's Black farmers you're not reaching. There's Black and brown and Latinx communities that you're not reaching. Chefs, markets, everything. So I looked at my ED and I was like, we got to figure something else out because this ain't going to work. as a doula with moms too, it's like my moms don't feel comfortable going to the markets to use their EBT. They don't feel comfortable going into a place with predominantly white farmers who already look at us a type of way when we walked in there to begin with, not, let alone pulling out an EBT card. So we began Patchwork Initiative. I had no grant or nothing because we're a nonprofit. So most of us are grant-driven. For programming to help a specific cause. And I looked at Martin, I was like, if you can find in general support, keep me on. I'm telling you, this is what we're doing. We're about to figure out the inequities and why it's so, there is no, what's the word? Inclusive. It's not inclusive. There's not inclusivity when it comes to our local food system. And that's a problem for me. So that began me being food justice organizer. And it's a blanketed thing because I'm dealing with moms or families who don't feel comfortable at the market using their assistance. We pioneered the Kentucky Double Dollars program where, okay, you're not getting enough numbers for WIC, you're not getting enough for SNAP, we're not getting enough redemption rate. Let's give them double what they get and see if we can get more. And that really brings even more of a diverse crowd. It really, truly does. But people are fortunate to talk to people and know about these things. And if you did not know, I always say that I need a shirt that says, if you don't ask, they won't tell. And that's real. I didn't know about Kentucky Double Dollars when I had my daughter. I used to get the stuff from the, you know, the place, from the WIC office. And they give you all this stuff. And they're like, yeah, fresh food, do it, do it. I didn't know how to cook it. I was raised in the country, but somebody else was fixing a lot of that stuff for me. I learned a lot, but there is a break in education where I was forced to learn because my grandparents had me. And then there was a, you know, a separation where people stopped working in the kitchen with their families. And because of that, you have people who are 35 and younger who truly do not know how to cook unless it's pre-processed. So giving them a ticket into a landscape that looks very white and you're a black and brown person, single mom, and you don't know how to do it, are you going to ask? You're not. So, and then the black farmer, we're 1%. For all the farmers in Kentucky, there is less than 500 farmers of color in Kentucky, black specifically. And so I was just like, I want to make it where people are more comfortable at the markets. I want to make it where my cohorts and my partners in this work are more comfortable with conversations about equity. And I wanted to make it where black farmers had a comfort zone to be able to tell their stories like I tell mine. And we use those stories as we have already to our commitment to equity of spreading that to, like, we now are working with Farm Service Agency, USDA, and that was my job when I get a call from a black farmer. Oh, I did this and nobody answered. I did this and they told me this. Or I got the runaround. It's my job now to call and be like, what's up? I mean, y'all have been already, the world knows that y'all have been treating black people like crap. So now that we've talked about it, now it's my job to make sure that that doesn't happen. But if the problem is happening simply because a conversation needs to be had, let's do that. And so that's my job now. Like, I am the equity person. I am the voice of black farmers. I am the push right now for that type of work here in Kentucky, which is amazing. And it's really exciting. And I had to say all of that for people for to really understand what does all of that mean. That's my job. Outside of that, I own Alfalfa's restaurant downtown Lexington. We just moved. That was a culture, local food system. Been supporting local farmers and local ag for the beginning, 1973. When they were about to sell, I was just like, I know farmers right now that sell directly to Alfalfa's. What are they going to do? And then there's black farmers who are looking for markets and was right on the cusp of doing like this big, working with black soil, like this market, like everybody was really like gunning, like it was really good. And it was like COVID. And people start to get real picky about what they wanted to do. And so by me buying Alfalfa's, I wanted to make sure that I was keeping local food in people's bellies, making food accessible. And you know, the representation of power, I ain't gonna lie. I watched Madam CJ Walker and I was just like, in the middle of a pandemic, she made something sell because it was a need. People still wanted to look nice. For me, people still wanted to hang out and eat good food. And I'm going to do that. And outside of that, I have a whole bunch of little girls and women that are looking at me that feel like they can't be what they want to be. I'm showing them little old Tiff is going to do this in the middle of a pandemic. It ain't somebody that you read in a book or a movie you watch. It's Tiff, the woman that's been nurturing and tutoring you since second grade. Now you see me and you're a young adult. And this is real story, young adult. And you're looking at me do this coming from where I came from. And it was just so much more than owning a restaurant. And it was amazing. We still own it, but we moved. So right now we're like calming it down. Own the restaurant, the farmer part, and then I'm a doula. I've been a doula for 15 years, 53 babies, and that is statewide. I had a baby in Ohio last year, and that's home births, C-sections, multiples, first. I wear the daddy band. Mama wear the daddy band. Daddy wear the daddy band. The little band they give you in the hospital. Like, there's so many levels to this work. And that work has gotten to the point where I used to just love just being with the mom, birthing, we doing all the happy baby stuff. It began because I'm a single mom. My birth story was horrible. I was in HUD, assisted living. So you're surrounded by women. They're else pregnant, postpartum, have a toddler. But we're all moms, really, almost for the first time, it felt like. And, I was the old mom, you know, like my daughter was the oldest out of all of us. And so there was times where we were scared. We didn't have anybody. And there was new mamas coming in, no mamas moving. But it got to the point where I was the person that were like, please come because I don't know what to ask. Please come help me breastfeed my baby because I don't know who to ask. Please come to the hospital because I don't feel safe. Can you read this stuff for me because it doesn't make no sense? And I'm like, y'all are in the hospital. First of all, why don't you feel comfortable to ask these questions? I had a mama. Some of these girls don't have moms or toxic, you know, and you can't ask these questions. So I started to go with them. Then it got to the point where there was a mother, she was Puerto Rican, and she didn't feel comfortable at all. And she didn't know. I just understood her. I don't know how that happened, but she didn't know where the WIC office was. She didn't know nothing about EBT. She didn't know the bus route. She didn't know anything. And I was just like, this is a thing. Did not know what a doula was. I just like the pregnancy best friend. I was like, women are going through postpartum worse and dying because they go in with anxiety and fear. Your heart is already beating outside your chest and your blood pressure is high. Then they want to take your baby by C-section. You're freaking out. Your recovery rate is horrible. Right. And so I realized like my role in that over the years has become this advocate, this speaking for the people who feel like they can't speak for themselves. And that's been that's it. Like,
what's like the common thread?
That's the common thread. Mm-hmm. Because I'm going to say it. I'm going to speak it. And I'm going to, and I don't care who gets mad about it. Sometimes I do, but most of the time I don't. And so, yeah, I'm a I am a full spectrum doula. I'm not certified. Certifications weren't a thing. It used to be that you could have 22 people in your room. There's a lot of rules now because we've given their voice back. They don't like that. Now we're telling you how we want our birth instead of going with your flow to make your work day better. And there's other things. That's a rabbit hole we don't have to go down. But now I have 5 doulas underneath me, 3 who want to train with me, and 5 teenagers that want to now be a doula in training because I'm getting teen moms. And we talked about the millennial thing. I mean, I don't want to talk to you like I talk to my own child. So my daughter doula 2 teenagers last year for me and sat up in there and cut up with them. And there was a great birth moment because she had 2 moms. She's hanging with somebody that's her age. And they had a lot of things to talk about. And Michaela did the postpartum too. Got her postpartum stuff ready for her and everything. So my daughter is definitely my prodigy with that. Now I'm switching to being a doula network. Almost like a staffing agency for holistic doula care for women, color exclusively, but I'm not limited to. I'm like, women are the change of the world. Mm-hmm. We was, we are, we will be. And so that's what this will be. And having a space and opportunity for other people to do the work that I'm doing. And I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm going to be training, doing herbs, doing a lot of the teas, the tinctures, the steams. I do placenta care. So I do a lot of ceremonial, traditional things with the placenta. Some encapsulate, some bury, We do artwork. So transitioning more to that stuff. So all of that, that's what I do.
Wow. That's a lot. Yeah, you wouldn't mind. Wear a lot of hats.
I do.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. It's like that's a full life, you know? It's a, like, memories, experiences, things you learn, things you pass along. And mm-hmm. That's a good life, it seems like.
And I'm not even 40 yet.
Yeah. So you were talking about this earlier also. I guess moving into the next portion. But I guess I want to ask about, like, the type of things you do here at your resident farm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess, yeah, first things first. I don't want to, like, make it too front-loaded of a question.
No.
But, like, I guess the things you grow here and mm-hmm. your connection to this land, like your ancestral connection.
Okay. I can make a really nice story about this and sum it up, but it's still going to be long. So one thing about me going through herbalism when I got my holistic remedy certification was I went to a class down at the old schoolhouse in Rockcastle County, and I took a workshop, and it was about identifying plants as they do for you. If the plant is dark red, dark purple, it's probably good for your blood. If it's super, like, turmeric and ginger, those things are good for inflammation. It's good for different parts of your system. So, like, identifying herbs in nature without a book, and, like, when you look at it, you know what it could help heal, right? This was a sense that I was born with without knowing that. And I was like, oh, it's a science. Like, this is really real. Okay, the plants really do talk to me. Almost in the sense like George Washington Carver. The same connection, if you've studied this man, the same connection that he knew we have with plants is the same way I feel too. That is that my vibration, my frequency in the land comes through me and to me when I step out on this land. Saying that, everything that I needed to be profitable, everything I needed to be successful on this land came to me like just leave it alone. Like, it was like in my brain, like ancestors saying, like, just be still and let it be. And in that time, I'm finding the elderberry, the borage, I'm finding the different wildlife. We have so many different ecosystems out here. I can bring people out here and teach them literally about everything that's needed about horticulture just from the different ways the land has been set up. And I feel like the ancestors put it such, like, when I realized elderberry was out there and where it's been my whole life, I was like, what? Could have been a millionaire. Not really. But the land itself, and all those stories are just to say that I'm where I'm supposed to be, and the ancestors made it as such. But this land has been in our family for over 100 years. My great-grandfather, Atrus Blue, was one of three brothers in Madison County, the Blue Brothers, and he was a sharecropper. I like to start his story at sharecropping because he worked his ass off. He was a hardworking man and worked so hard to be able to be like not most people in his time, but to obtain land, start a family, maintain that land, develop and grow that land for your generations for 4 or 5 years to still have, right? Because I'm a fifth generation. And it's just kind of like, it's kind of, he was born a slave. Sharecropping is the only way that they had out at that time, right? When I was kindergarten, I was 4 going on 5. I remember it was like yesterday. We took care of my great-grandfather in this house. I would come home from school and he was there. I got up and drank coffee with him every morning. I call him Giddy Boost. I couldn't say grandfather, granddaddy, I guess. I don't know where Giddy Boost came from, but Giddy Boost is what I called him. When we talk about Atrus, everybody's like, oh, yeah, Giddy Boost. That's what I called him. This man was in the military, served his country several times, and built churches and houses and railroads and a lot of the land that's cultivated here in Madison County come from the hands of labor of my great-grandfather and my great-uncles, right? And just to say that is just amazing. When he was at his deathbed. He had full diabetes. Both his legs were amputated. And I got up in the bed and I knew that he was dead. I knew he was gone. I told my granny he was gone. He left. He was gone. And I would hear more stories about this man and who he was. And then, like, even to my grandmother, I got pictures of my grandmother at this house. My grandmother's a teenager. And there's nothing but a house and that church across the street. That's it. There's nothing else out here. And an old outhouse. And that old outhouse burned down a couple times. People still smoking out there. We're not supposed to. I was not thought of, okay? These are times where my mama was thought of. And it was a good time out here. People would have their family reunions out here. Our family reunion, Blue brought us Simpson Nolan, one of the oldest family reunions in the state of Kentucky, come out here. Funerals would come out here and have their repasses. Like, this was a place of community then. And so when I was born and then great-grandfather died and I'm living out here, I just remember the gatherings. I remember all the things that were out here. And I'm just like, now being 37... Now being 37 and being the one, I knew that it wasn't by chance that I actually got myself together and was able to obtain this. I mean, I was crazy. I was a crazy 20-year-old, and I was like, my grandparents are never going to leave it to me. But I showed my grandparents something that I could handle it. And when I got this land, all I knew was that I was going to have a business and everybody was going to know my family's last name. Because for that gap between because it was 1988, I was four. But a gap between being four and being about 30, I learned so much of the root of my family here. That this land has been here for over 100 years. My grandfather died. He was 100 years old. We had just celebrated his 100th birthday. He got this land when he was in his 20s, 30s. Yeah, late 30s. So, to subtract that, that's like 70 years that of him being having this property. And then you fast forward and I'm 30. So it's, you know, it's been about 120-something years, 115-something years that it's been in our land. And so the land itself, people have died here. My grandparents died in this house. My great-grandfather and my great-grandmother died in that house. On the actual land, there were babies that were born that didn't make it. There's a cemetery in the back of the white people who were Cornelisons that used to live here. There's a lot of trauma and good footprints that have been through this land. And being that I am I'm very spiritual. I very much so live a spiritual life where I know I'm connected to the befores and afters. So knowing that I'm an ancestor return, and that there's a literal sense in that, but it's literally I'm taking on the stories of all the ancestors before me, aunts that have been catching babies on this land, aunts and other women and cousins who were the first school teachers who were teaching sharecroppers how to handle their business, women who were going outside to get education, coming back in, teaching their men. You know, it was a whole lot of that happened on this land. So when you fast forward to it's my land and now it's for me, I was told by my high priestess, you've got to continue to have community out there, most importantly women. And you have to bring women and children out there and you have got to teach them the way that you were taught. You've got to teach them. And that's what I did. And I didn't know how to start that. I was abused on this land by my ex-spouse. Broke my leg. Almost lost. The estate was almost in. They tried to take the estate from us. And that could be a question if you want me to dig. And I won't dig in that right now. But when I got it, there was a lot of me having to pull it back to get it. It was a lot of crazy stuff. Heirs lost property is a big thing, and there's nobody that helps you with it. So I'm trying to figure it out, and all I can hear is my grandparents just talking to me in my head, and I'm just like, I can't lose this land. Like, I can't lose this land. And my mom's trying to help too, and I'm just thinking, like, what do we do? And in the midst of that, the domestic violence happened, And I found myself at the bottom, and my ancestors were like, just get up. Just get up. Everything that you want is already here. That was before I saw the elderberry. That was before that I knew about the pollinators, you know, being gapped. And I, like, you need to grow milkweed. Get up and grow milkweed. Like, it was like crazy little signs for 3 years of me trying to struggle through, trying to do what I'm supposed to do with this land. Ultimately, I dug on pollinators. We got a conservation grant. That was a big role. I looked up one day and I was like, you're right, I need women out here. I asked for women, send me $5, let's come out here, I'll get some arts and crafts. We got to do something on this land. Like, it's calling, we got to do something on this land. That was my first annual, my inaugural women's retreat. And this year will be my 7th annual women's retreat. And I have women from all over the United States that come now. And the first women's retreat, I was growing my little mints and stuff, and I let them try that. And again, this is the ancestors driving me. I can't tell no other way. I sit out there and meditate and just be like, tell me what to do. Tell me what to do. And like, I just started growing stuff. I started eating flowers. I started like going into herbalism because I was like, okay, the ancestors, like, they're here. And it was as easy as like dandelions. Like, they're like, don't cut the dandelions. And then it's like dandelion root. Dandelion root was one of the main ingredients in one of my teas. It sells off. It's like, everybody loves it. It's like, they were telling me elderberry started popping up, started making a tea. So I have tea blends that I sell across the United States as well now. From the pollinator conservation. Ancestors tell me, conserve it, conserve it, conserve it. When I used to grow up out here, there was deers and rabbits, and, you know, people wanted to come out to the country for the experience. And I had to start, we had to start all over again. Like, we had to start all over again. Like, the whole entity of what it was as this land to be. And when I decided to brand that, like I said, from the beginning, I knew that I was going to carry this name to the ends of the earth. So it's Blue Estate. When I picked up that deed, it was Blue Estate. When I went to the courthouse, it was Blue Estate. I'm fighting for the Blue Estate. Like, I'm fighting for Blue Estate. And so I branded it as such. So now we're a household name. Like, we're a Kentucky Proud, Appalachian Proud, Blue Estates LLC business. I get to show off my grandmother's artwork. We're working on prints of my grandmother's artwork. And my grandmother's artwork is history. You know? It's not just some random picture. Like, and every year I get to develop more about what it is to reconnect myself and people to the land and teach them about my ancestral lineage. And the crazy thing is when I start to talk, at least two people out of a group, I don't care if I'm in Georgia, Texas, Kentucky, at my house, your house, it doesn't matter. If there's a group of people and there's black people and they want to learn about agriculture, Kentucky, I walk away being related to at least two of them.
No way.
I swear to God. So my network just keeps on growing because people...
You're related?
The sharecropping.
I see.
People had kids in other places. People uprooted for different reasons. People moved away. People had kids. There was so much like generational trauma in Richmond. And then like my great-grandfather, like the, it's just when you look at the how black people, when most of them come from Virginia... And as they did this, it's like Richmond, Madison, Jessamine, Scott, Franklin, Clark, Montgomery, Powell. It's like that central eastern Kentucky region. And people are like, I don't know why we all cousins. It's because our great grandfathers were sharecropping. Some were married, some were settled. They were having kids. Their kids were having kids. People were getting raped. It was a lot.
I see.
That I learned. But yeah, since the healing of the land, we've had, and that's what I call it, the women's retreat now is considered the healing of the land. We come out here, we have a very spiritual time. We do washes and cleanses, and everybody takes their shoes off, and we ground, and and then we bring the children out here. Kids don't run outside anymore.
They don't.
So kids come here, they put all their phones on the thing. and they just take off. If I go to the city, everybody's like, we want to go with you, TT. Because, like I said, my job is to speak for the people who do not have voices. It's not that they don't have them. They don't think they have them anymore. And the youth is part of that.
Right.
And so we bring them out here. I have some girls that help me pick out harvest. I have some that help me get ready for the new season. I got a couple of teenagers that want to help me clean out my high tunnel. Because they want to work, but they don't want to work with somebody where they feel like there's bossing them. So they come out here. And we have conversations, and they want to ask me all the things, you know, and that's something that my grandma used to do, too. Like, that picture up there that I showed you when we first walked in, she's at the library teaching the kids how to draw and color. She didn't start painting till she was 40.
Wow.
Classes at 40. Not painting at 40. Like, she started taking classes at 40 and then decided that she wanted to be a painter.
Wow.
She showed her, yeah. So it's just, you know, ancestrally, a lot of my ancestors have their tales that got left to lay on this land. And that energy is still very much so here. And with that energy, I am challenging people to rethink how they want to live their lives. And also challenging people to go back. I'm big on psych. There are stages of your development psychologically, and we miss a lot of those pieces trying to grow up so fast. That self-actualization and belonging, we miss that. So you have a lot of adults then trying to regress back into childlike ways, very immature, temper tantrums. They can't think out life. They're not sure of themselves. They're not confident. A lot of women, they just are doing what they think they're supposed to be doing instead of being their authentic self. And that is something that I need us to be more powerful in ourselves. And I feel like when they come out here and they take their shoes off, it's like a million women are just like vibrating underneath their feet. Like, come on, come on. And I'm telling you, I've had women come back. I think I don't say I'm the reason for it, but when I tell women, you're going to come out here and get your life changed, it's not me. And I'm speaking from the ancestors. You coming out here to get your life changed. And women have started new relationships, marriages, had made babies, like literally manifested babies, businesses. My success rate is amazing. I'm like, this is wow. But again, I couldn't do it without me being here on this land. They'd be like, you gonna do it anywhere else? No. It's a purpose for everybody to be out here, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm going down rabbit holes. I'll stop talking.
No, that's good. I know there's a lot of farmers who don't. I think every farmer I've talked to has some spiritual connection to the land they work, you know?
Yeah.
But it just means something different to some different people.
So mm-hmm.
I know that ultimately, like, some people feel that environmental stewardship is important because mm-hmm. if you didn't, then the land would just, you know, if you didn't use proper practices to maintain it, and it wouldn't be, you couldn't grow anything. You know? Otherwise, if you just... So I think a lot of farmers recognize that, and I guess it's my next question,
mm-hmm.
my final question, too,
mm-hmm.
is just about, like, your views on, like, just sustainability,
mm-hmm.
and also given the fact that, talking about, you know, helping young people, raising them and expecting that the future, the world's not going to look the same.
Exactly.
With climate change and everything.
Right.
So what is your approach because of the future? You know, what it's going to look like?
When I'm asked this question, the two biggest things that come up to me is permaculture and ag tech. I need my people to be well-rounded. Like, you probably will never see me out here with a tractor. I grew up with a tractor back then, right? The blend for me is that I know I can get a tiller out here. I know it would make it easier for me. And I do till my land sometimes, some of it. But when I bring people out here, when I teach them about permaculture, I tell them it's still work. The best permaculture is cultivated. It takes years for it to actually look the way where you could walk away, but you still got work to do. It's just not so... tedious is not the word, but anyways, I try to explain to people, like, nature has a life of its own. You don't have to force nature.
Right.
So understanding your systems. So like for me, I can do herbs out there and never till it. I don't. I can cut it real, real, real low, put some dirt down, put my, you know, and it's taking it all. My mints and my, especially my mints, my catnips and mints and stuff, they are permaculture. I don't do no till, no nothing. And then, you know, there's places that I do till, and it breaks my heart to do it, but I have to do it because of the clay soil. I have to turn it over. I want people to be more mindful. Like, I'm not just turning it over because I think the rows are going to look prettier. Sustainability to me is like, it's a catchphrase. Everybody's like, sustainability, sustainability. What does that mean? I need this to sustain itself or be sustainable enough that I can sustain it. A lot of sustain. Like, you know, if the rows make it easier for you and your crops, that's sustainable for you. You don't know how to maintain the permaculture. You can take 1,000 classes on permaculture. You're like, that's just not for me. I need people to know how to do it all and then pick the best practice. Mm. And that's what I tell my farmers. If you're an urban grower, you want to till your lot, till your lot. If you would rather use raised garden beds, use raised garden beds. Do what you want to do, what's more feasible. But understand what you're doing and why you're doing it, because you're going to have to add nutrients back into it. I cover crop everything. So it's not, people like, you know, I till, so then I cover crop. No, like, I cover crop everything because it's replenishing and regenerating my soil no matter what. And a lot of people don't even understand the being regenerative. That's the word I want to use, yes. Versus sustainable. Because there are some sustainable practices that just don't fit, and they just think I need to do it because I want to be sustainable. But you are not regenerating your soil. You're not even... to that. I practice very organically. I'm not organic, but the biggest piece is why I go out there and do what I do is not for profit. It is to put my hands in the dirt and be connected to everything that I'm touching out there. I got sidetracked for a second. Sorry, give me my brain back. Sustainable also for me is price points. People think sustainable for the earth, that's great, but sustainable for your prices. So as the world changes, there shouldn't be a barrier of how you can grow your own food. So because of that, if I have some teenagers that I know don't want to and will never understand a tiller, I know that I can give them buckets and they can grow out the buckets. They did, they do, they loved it. And if I took them out to the farm and was like, here's a hoe, they'd be looking at me like, you're crazy. I don't want it that bad. Like, and they would. They'd be really straight up with me about it. So when I bring people out here, I really want to understand, like, you know, they'll come out here and they'll be like, oh, you have a farm. And I'm like, just get out here first, because it's not what you think it is. I have 4 acres, but I do not have what you feel like is a farm. But I'm growing food. It's sustainable. I have enough food for myself. I have enough food for a bag business. And I have no tractor, no tiller, no none of that. What was you gonna say?
No.
I've kind of strayed away from the sustainable word.
It has become sort of like a one of those meaningless catchphrases.
It's just watered down. Right. Like, yeah. People are like, so I got a hoop house and I've got high tunnel and I'm gonna grow sustainably, and I'm like, do you know how much work that is?
Yeah, yeah.
It's really not. You can grow year-round. That's beautiful. If you don't know what you're growing, that could be expensive. And you have a whole nother system that you need to figure out. If it's sustainable for what you're doing, it makes sense. But if it's not, then it's not, you know?
Yeah.
We do a lot of... we turn our crops. I'm really big on... like, I've been reading Farming While Black. I'm really big at wanting to learn the old style, OO styles. So we do a lot of broadcasting, and so then I take the old, and with the current crop diversity, that's the biggest thing in new growers now. Not just, you know, one thing. We grow a lot of different things because it's regenerative, right? Kill your soil just growing the same thing over and over. You got to add so much phosphorus, so much nitrogen. learning the science about it, and then taking what the future could look like as far as ag tech, the current ag tech. Yes, you can have small plots of land and still use technology to make it easier. Drip irrigation on a schedule, bringing in timers for lamps. There's just different systems. And my goal is as we're talking and doing, that the perfect young beginning farmer, doesn't have to be young, but young from, I use young because millennials do things from them. They will do different from my daughter, and then my daughter's kids will be different. So I would like for everybody to embrace the old, blend it with the present, and be accepting of the new, understanding that as long as you can grow food for yourself and potentially your community, it doesn't matter what it looks like, but be understanding and knowledgeable of what it can look like. My grandfather would have killed me if he saw how I was growing out here. Like, my grandfather had a tobacco stick in a line, and I had to stick it, go to another one, stick it, and it had to be straight. The tobacco farm, 200 acres of tobacco, okay? Lines. And
wow.
And that was the right way, honey.
Right.
6 inches to the T. Like, there was no other way. And that's discouraging because now I have farmers coming to me like, how did you break away from that? Because my uncles are on my head, or my grandfather, or my granny, and I'm just like, you have to be ready to just be able to explain, this is that, and this is what I know is coming down the line, but at the end, I can grow the food.
Right.
In this climate, because that ag tech is what's going to help save our asses as the climate change happens. You're going to have to need technology because nature is trying to figure it out. Nature is adapting right now. How long does adaptation really take before it's like, the you know, Earth is kind of like, oh my God. I feel like Earth is anxious right now.
Yeah.
And we have these freak moments of things, and things could grow, maybe not grow. Because of that, you can't do it like it was for a long time. You just can't. And I'm one of those people that are fighting ag tech. I don't really want technology on my phone, on my farm, because I want to touch everything.
Yeah.
I want my energy. I don't want the energy of technology out here. I just got Wi-Fi 5 years ago, but I am into conservationism, and I understand the climate change, and I understand that maybe one day you might not have no technology, and that's something else that I have conversations with. What happens if one day, that'd be spooky. What happens one day if it really happens and it really is like all black? What do you do? Then you need to know these primitive things. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I don't know. It's one of those questions where I know what I'm doing, but it changes for myself as well. And some things have worked great some years, and some years it hasn't because of the climate. Appalachian climate is stupid. You never know what's going to happen out here. Like, is it going to rain? Is it a tornado? Is it a flood? Is it a drought? Oh, okay, it's a drought today. And no matter how you get it going, it's like, it would have been easier if I would have had these, you know? So.
Yeah, it definitely seems like a lot of, especially Appalachian farmers, tend to be very adaptable. And I think, like, that's a skill that's going to, because you seem like a very adaptable person. Mm-hmm. You're able to just adapt to different challenges. And like you're saying, it depends on everything. That's a skill I think would be when the climate does start to change. That's going to be what's going to save us.
Yeah.
To adapt.
Yeah. I'm pretty scared about it.
Yeah.
It's complete water underneath me. So as we know, Kentucky was completely underneath water.
Right.
Southeast Kentucky is still underneath water. That's how I feel about it. And because, I mean, one bad rain and all my farmers is wiped out. They don't deal with drought as much as they do with the flooding. We had a drought season here because we are up, our sea level is different. They have more of that sandy stuff down there. We have more of the clay. So when it's a drought season, it's a drought season. Doesn't matter how much I water it, like, I've lost a lot of crop to that. And I've had to diversify myself to the point where it's like, herbs grow great as hell out here. Blackberries and elderberries, and that's where I'm at. I grow produce for myself. Like, I like my own fresh stuff out there because I like to grow my own stuff, right? But the imagination that I would, like, I can grow enough for a farm to table dinner, but the imagination that I would grow enough to be a large scale market, even with 26 acres, no. It's not going to happen. The land's not ready for it. Like, this land is not for that. So, and it's scary to think as we get hotter, the drastic change between drought and flood, because all of that gets water. It's just water. All of that's water. The resilient things are great, but they're not enough of them to be just like, I'm just a farmer and I grow these three things and they pay all my bills. No. And I think that's what people need to get out of the thought of, is like you said, farmers do it for spiritual reasons. We take care of this land and growing it because it is in our family, it is in our blood, it is our birthright. But in hindsight, just lost my whole train of thought.
Talking about the things that are resilient, and that you mentioned water and that you can plant things that are resilient.
Yes, farmers, we're, that's what I was going to say, thank you. Yeah. We are connected to the land because of ancestral spiritual things, right? Only about 50% of us really think we're going to make a profit. And for people who come into agriculture to make a profit, they are in it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
Right. Completely the wrong reasons. And even into that, like, people really be like, oh, you got a farm, you own a business, da, da, da. I'm not here for that. Blessed be the people who have paid for tours and time out here with me and, you know, all the things that I do, but it's reciprocal. Like, anything somebody invests into this land, I'm going to give it back out to them, you know? It has never been my goal to... I'm in stores. People do buy wholesale. It's beautiful, but that's not why, you know, I'm here to continually regenerate this here land so there is a seventh and eighth generation. And the act of businesses on land talking about being sustainable, there is no tobacco farming. There is, but it's not like it used to be. There's no tobacco, there's no cotton, the hemp industry is now flooded again, and there's no buyers. So the things that we used to do as Black people, and I say Black people exclusively, it's like you can't do that no more. So you have to find other shit to do on your farm. And that is the sustainable piece to it. You have to use your farm for other things. And most of my friend farmers, farmer friends, they have turned it into an Airbnb, agribusiness, as far as coming out and learning how to shear your sheep or make cheese. Agritourism, yes. Yeah. And
that's becoming more popular.
And it's just diversifying. They're still selling their eggs. They're still selling vegetables or their value-added products. But they know that they can't do that alone. And that, to me, is the sustainability piece to farming specifically. And what I feel like we teach our kids. Like, that's what I'm teaching my daughter and every kid that comes out here. I do a lot of conversations about financial literacy. And they're just like, you know, why did you become a business and this and this and the third? And I break it down to them, like, I took what I had and I made the most out of it, not what people thought it should be. And so people, and that's the same thing with farming. I took farming and agriculture and turned it into what I think people needed, not what I thought people thought farming was, you know, or is, you know. Like, people get land and be like, I'm going to go buy a tractor and buy some plants. I'm like, why? Like, what does that help you do? If you're doing that for a reason, do that for a reason. But if you're just wasting resources where you could have done something else to build your family and your community in a different way, instead of the expectation of being a farmer and owning land, your impact is so much more. And that's me. Impactful work. I don't just want to make money.
Right,
right. Make an impact.
Work that impacts people.
Yeah.
I think that's a good place to stop, really.
Let's try.
No, yeah, you did. That's good. Is there anything else like, I may not have asked that you wanted to add?
I mean, my mom's the only child, so my grandparents died, my mom, me, that's it. So, 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm fourth generation. Sorry, I said fifth earlier. My daughter is fifth.
I see.
So, but like, there's not a whole lot of us. A lot of times it's like, you had to tear it up. you know, there's so many siblings and all these people. My mom stays in Lexington. She gave me the house. She knew that I would do what's best for it. We work collectively as executors of this here estate, but all of this come from just my pretty old head. I just decided this is what I wanted to do. My mom supports me, and knowing that my grandparents would have supported the same thing. So yeah. It's pretty cool.
I definitely think so. This is like kind of a dream that I would like to have. You know?
That's what everybody says. I'm like, can I be you? Yeah. And I'm just like, it's crazy. It's because my life is crazy. I'm also, not that it has to be on record, but.